So first of all, let's finalize our final verses of the eighth canto. We're up to chapter 8,
Canto 8, chapter 24, text 48.
So, these are prayers by the king, and that would be King Satchabrata. I'll just read the translations. I'll just go back to where we started. He says, text 46, that the king said, "By the grace of the Lord, those who have lost their self-knowledge since time immemorial and who because of this ignorance are involved in a material conditional life full of miseries, obtain the chance to meet the Lord's devotee. I accept that Supreme Personality of Godhead as the Supreme Spiritual Master." So, we discussed this, that ultimately, Krishna is the guru, and we discussed how when we perform Vyasa Puja, I was hearing a class, sort of Prabhupada was saying that, you know, Vyasa Puja means worship of Krishna. It's worship of the teachings of the Personality of Godhead. If someone represents the teachings of the Personality of Godhead, they become guru, and they are to be worshipped as good as Krishna. Shaksha Darigve Samasu Sastre Uktasta Tava Vyati Visadbi Kintu Prabhu Priya Vitasya Vande Guru Shri Charanaravinda. In this verse, we see that by the grace of the Lord, one gets a chance to meet the Lord's devotee. And therefore, in essence, the Personality of Godhead, who is the spiritual master, may sometimes speak himself or send someone else to speak on his behalf. Either way, it's the Lord speaking. So, when he's saying, "I accept that Supreme Personality of God is as the Supreme Spiritual Master," doesn't mean that he is jumping over the Guru. In fact, he's accepting the Guru. That's his. So, you know, just like, of course, this Satchabrata, this large golden fish, Lord Matsya, who was 8 million miles long, he appeared on the ocean of inundation, and this. The Lord had predicted that a boat would be coming to Satchabrata just before the inundation, and he saw that boat coming near and he jumped on it, and then later he saw the Matsya avatar, and he anchored the boat to the fish's horn in this very, you know, powerful waters of inundation. So, in effect, you know, the boat, the appearance of Vasuki, the snake to anchor it, the appearance of the Lord, they're all Krishna. So similarly, the guru is also Krishna. Then he says, in the hopes of becoming happy in this material world, the foolish conditioned soul performs fruitive activities that result only in suffering, but by rendering service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one becomes free from such false desires for happiness. May my Supreme Spiritual Master cut the knot of false desires from the core of my heart. So, now for the pundits who were here or heard the class last time, what verses from the Bhagavad Gita did we spend practically that whole chapter discussing this matching incarnation? We spoke certain verses of the Bhagavad Gita. What were they? From 4:12, and we went up to about 4:14. Yeah, 4:12. We discussed 4:12 because the Lord says that He is not part, although He creates the natural order of Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Sudras, because in this world, every living entity is either under sattva, rajas, or tamas, and human beings from Brahma right down, you know, to the little Indra Gopa germ. Everyone is influenced by the modes of material nature in this world, unless they're a pure devotee, and therefore they're either under sattva, rajas, or tamas, a mixture of the both. Therefore, the Lord created this Varnashram system by which everyone can perform their duty according to their natural tendencies, according to the body they have received under the modes of material nature, and at the same time, if they think of the Supreme Lord, who is transcendental to the Varnashram, although He created the Varnashram, they can actually achieve perfection. So, when the Supreme Lord, we know that people understand where there's Vishnu Tattva. And then there's Das Avatara, the principal avatars, of which there's Matsya, Varaha, there's Krishna, there's Balaram. So when they get to Krishna and Balaram, they think, oh, you know, he's performing activities like a human being within the Varnashram, he's acting as someone's son, as the son of a Vaishya, the son of a Kshatriya, you know, as a married person like this. But when they get to Matsya Avatar, how do they apply the same, you know, how does an 8 million mile long fish, you know, who grows within a day or something, from the size of a little tiny goldfish to one that swims about happily in the waters of the ocean of inundation. So, therefore, you know, this busts the ridiculous conception that the avatars, and even if one considers Krishna one of the avatars, he is Vishnu Tattva, he's accepted as Vishnu Tattva, Balaram is Vishnu Tattva, Lord Ramchandra, Vishnu Tattva, Lord Vamanadeva, Vishnu Tattva, although they are in the human form, they are not part of the, they're not one of the conditioned souls within the material universe. They are transcendental to it, but it is manifestations of the forms or the one supreme personality of Godhead. And if one meditates upon that Lord, one will also become free from the that one will become as transcendental as the Lord. And therefore the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 4:9, I think we actually went back to that one. We actually went back even further to about 4, 6, and 7. Actually, why does the Lord appear? He appears, Hida Hida Hidamasha, not for any karma, but by his own will, in his own spiritual form, just to, remove irreligion, present the religious principles appropriate for the time, and also to protect his devotees from the irreligious persons and to destroy the rascals. And one who therefore understands that the Lord is appearing just to maintain the order of religious principles, not just mundane religious principles, but he is teaching the supreme religious principle, because in the Gita he says, give up all your religious principles under the modes of material nature and just surrender unto me. So he's teaching supreme transcendental religious principles. And one who understands that that's the purpose of his appearance, to guide us back to the spiritual world, that person does not take birth again. So then we, discussed that in that chapter, it went on to describe that in 14, that the Lord said, there's no work that affects me, nor do I aspire for the fruits of action. One who understands this truth about me also does not become entangled in the fruitive reactions of work. In verse 15, he says, all the liberated souls in ancient times acted with this understanding and so attained liberation. Therefore, as the ancients, acharyas, you should perform your duty in this divine consciousness. So he goes on to describe that it's very hard to understand, even the great sages, they can't understand what is action, what is forbidden action, and what is inaction. We all have our prescribed duties within the varnish realm or the religious principles. Those actions are performed to get a particular material result in this world. But if we do it under the guidance of the Lord, we're also treading the path of liberation as well. We should never perform forbidden actions, which we're not allowed to perform, such as killing the cow. And we should never be attached to not doing our duty, because that is also a forbidden action. But above everything, if we actually perform our activities for the pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it is called akkarma, or inaction. There's no material reaction to it. So one who understands the nature of Krishna, that if we do some activity for the Personality of Godhead, we will not get a material reaction, we'll only get spiritual progress. And therefore, as it says, knowing that, one becomes liberated. Knowing Krishna, one becomes liberated, and knowing how to act in Krishna consciousness, one becomes liberated. And it says then, verse 18, one who sees inaction in action, action in inaction, is intelligent among men, and he is transcendental position, although engaged in all sorts of activities. Even though he's doing so many activities, whether as a sudra, they're not a sudra, but they're serving Krishna. They're just like when, in the temple here, Someone is sweeping the courtyard. Someone is cleaning the toilets. If they're Krishna conscious, they're not a Sudra, although that is the Sudra's work. They're actually Brahman. If they're Krishna conscious. And one who is understood to be in full knowledge, whose every act is devoid of desire for sense gratification, he is said by sages to be a worker whose fruit of action is burned up by the fire of perfect knowledge. See, so that's where this verse comes in here. That's where we're taking off. It's the same theme here. You know, so we've described that, you know, Satchabrata is describing that how the Lord sends the devotee to give the spiritual knowledge. That here is the personality of Godhead, surrender unto him. Don't perform fruitive activities which are karmically binding, but you can perform devotional service, and that is our karma that is not binding, and it will take you back to Godhead. So that is the knowledge, how to do that. And in this verse, 47, it says, in the hopes of becoming happy in this material world, the foolish conditioned soul performs fruitive activities that result only in suffering. But by rendering service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one becomes free from such false desires for happiness. May the Supreme Spiritual Master cut the knot of false desires from the core of our heart. So it's the same teaching as the Bhagavad Gita, except here it's being played out in this pastime with Lord Matsya and Satchabrata. And then in the next verse, 48, he says, one who wants to be free from material entanglement should take to the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and give up the contamination of ignorance involving pious and impious activities. So, pious activities is karma, that's prescribed duties. Impious activities is vikarma, forbidden activities. But when we perform akarma, it is neither. Thus one regains his original identity, just as a block of gold or silver sheds all dirt and becomes purified when treated with fire. May that inexhaustible Supreme Personality of Godhead become our spiritual master, for he is the original spiritual master of all other spiritual masters. And now, of course, we had that nice example in that purport that as gold and silver can be freed from all dirty contamination by being put into a fire, but not merely by being washed. The living entity can be awakened to his own identity by performing devotional service, but not by karma, jnana, or yoga. So it must be devotional service. And there, now that is the message of Krishna in the Gita. Give up your karma, your jnana, your astanga, and all other types of religion. You must take the devotional service if you want to be properly connected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Revive your original position as the eternal loving servant of the Lord, and then you can be properly situated. So that is the teaching of Krishna. That is, therefore, in that purport, this is what we got up to. Yaradeka Tarikaha Krishna Upadesh. The bona fide guru is he who advises his disciples exactly in accordance with the principles spoken by Krishna. The bona fide guru is he who has accepted Krishna as guru. This is the Guru Parampara system. The original guru is Vyasadeva, because he is the speaker of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, where everything spoken relates to Krishna. Therefore, Guru Puja is known as Vyasa Puja. So, Vyasa Puja means that we are worshipping that Guru because everything he speaks is the teachings which all relate to Krishna. That is Krishna Upadesh. One cannot become a guru if he does not know what the personality of Godhead Krishna or his incarnation wants. The mission of the guru is the mission of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. So we discussed this, that basically Lord Chaitanya, everyone can become guru. Prabhupada has said that many, many times. One simply has to repeat the message of Krishna without changing it. And we had a bit of a discussion on that, that it's a very liberal statement. It means that anyone who's properly teaching the science of Krishna according to, you know, what they've learned to the best ability, you know, just presenting from the very beginning, we can always present what we've heard. We hear something. Prabhupada gave this example, little Saraswati. She was about a few years old. And she'd go up to someone. Who is God? Some non-devotee had come to a Sunday love feast. He's just a child. Who is God? Oh, I don't know. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, she would say. Prabhupada always gave that example. She's guru. Because she is... She's... you see? Prabhupada gave an example. She's preaching. Perfectly. She, exactly as she heard it, she gave it. She's just a young child. She doesn't know. You ask her, you know, what is Dasamula Tattva, and what, you know, what are the 10 aspects of, you know, Sambandhagyan. You know, she may not know the technicality, but for what she's heard, she's just repeating what she's heard, she's perfect. So Prabhupada gave the example that, you know, if a child comes up to the father and says, you know, what are these spectacles, as Prabhupada would call them, and the father says to the child, these are spectacles, and they help you, they help one to see. If the child, someone asks the child, what are they? They're spectacles. The child has perfect knowledge. That is our process. So, therefore it's a very liberal statement which applies from the very beginning. All one has to do is simply repeat what one has heard and sincerely practice what one has been taught to the best of one's ability. Like that. And of course, Prabhupada did mention, you know, about the difference between Bali Maharaj and Sukracharya, that not every guru has the same level of knowledge. So as they surrender to Krishna, they will have more and more. So, you know, and so guru means heavy. So he who is the heaviest in transcendental knowledge, we try to take the knowledge from them. Any questions there? Just so far? Yep. So then he says, so we had a little discussion about the, what do you call them? The Ritvik. That, because they feel the Prabhupada is the only guru. So then, that means, if they feel the Prabhupada is the only guru, it means they don't understand the activities of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his teachings, and they don't understand the teachings of Krishna. And as Krishna says in the Gita himself, in the same fourth chapter, that it comes down in parampara. It's a chain of disciplic succession. Krishna says that very clearly, that Ivam parampara praptam imana rajasaya vidu sakalina matta yoganasta prantapa. The supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession. It's not heard by one person and then it stops. He says very clearly that it's heard in a chain, just like, as it describes here in this purport, Krishna incarnated as Vyasadeva, one of the incarnations of Krishna, who recorded, he wrote down what Krishna had said to Arjuna. So, as Prabhupada says, you know, therefore Arjuna is the Acharya. So there's guru number one. Oh, guru number one is Krishna. Next guru is Arjuna. Because we understand the Bhagavad Gita through Arjuna. Because Arjuna said, Krishna, I totally accept everything that you have told me. That's how we understand the Gita through Arjuna. And Vyasadeva is a compiler of all the Vedas, and he also accepted what Krishna told Arjuna, what Arjuna accepted, I also accept. Therefore we understand it through Vyasadeva. And because Vyasadeva is a compiler of all the Vedas, and he considers the Gita to be the essence, the Gita Upanishad, of all the Upanishadic knowledge, therefore we're understanding again through the compiler of all Vedas is corroborated. Yes, whatever Krishna says, that is the essence of everything I've written in the Vedas. So here's that guru, you know, so Arjuna as a guru is very important to us. It's not just what Krishna said, the fact that Arjuna accepted it is very important, you know, for us, that is acting as a guru. And the fact that Vyasadeva, the compiler of the Vedas, accepted it is very important to us. So each guru is not, although they're just repeating what Krishna said, but their own contribution is particularly relevant, required. Become, yes, because then, you know, Sukadeva Goswami, of course, was relishing the rasa of Bhagavatam, and because it was spoken by him in such ecstatic, you know, Rasika Bhakta, then again we derive more than perhaps the scholastic, you know, knowledge of Vyasadeva. And then as it comes down from, you know, through the ages, then each acharya has made sure that for what is possible, how it should be couched, so the same message received and understood. So, for instance, if you go back to the days of, you know, Arjuna, Vyasadeva, this Sanskrit is what they call very reformed language, using the Devanagari Sanskrit, this Devanagari alphabet. So therefore, very elevated language. As we come down into Kali Yuga, that we don't speak fluent. I'm Australian. I don't even speak fluent Australian. I had to have elocution lessons as a kid. Had to get some education. So, therefore, the acharas then had to present it sometimes in, you know, the local languages, break the Sanskrit down so without changing the message. And then, you know, and then as Prabhupada, then it's got to go into, you know, Asia and America and, you know, Africa and places like that. And then the guru has to realize that some of the concepts that are being spoken, even in the Bhagavad Gita, are concepts which have never appeared in the whole history of their culture or language. So, you know, therefore, the guru is not just necessarily repeating. We don't call Sukha, you know, Sukha because he repeated like a parrot. It's because his, you know, that rasa contribution, ecstatic contribution of recitation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Therefore, the guru parampara is, you know, otherwise, you know, it's not just you get a tape recorder and just record it. There is requirement for a current guru who can actually enter into the hearts of the persons of that current time, place and circumstance to present that message and make it applicable without changing anything. That takes a lot. Yeah. See? So the guru parampara is very important. So therefore, considering all those things, it's ridiculous to say that it's just going to stop with Prabhupada. Right? And so here, although Satyabrata is accepting, he's praying, may that Supreme Personality of God become our spiritual master. He's praying that Krishna becomes our spiritual master. That doesn't mean he's jumping over. He's already accepted that, you know, he will send the devotees, the guru, you know, to everyone in particular time when they need it. And what he's saying there, he knows that for thousands and thousands of years, for time immemorial, in this world, Krishna will always send the guru, and it will be the person who's appropriate for that particular time. And that's how we accept Krishna as the person of Godhead, because only the personality of Godhead can do that. Who's going to be there in 10,000 years to send a guru to the people in some remote part of the world? Who's going to do that? Krishna. Who's going to take up that role of always making sure the guru is sent? Only God can do that. Therefore, he is the spiritual master in that sense. So that's what the prayer is. Not saying that we directly jump to God. So that's where we got up to last week. And that was a little summary, just to recap and add a little bit more. Then he says, neither all the demigods, nor the so-called gurus, nor all other people, either independently or together, can offer mercy that equals even 1/10,000th of yours. Therefore, I wish to take shelter of your lotus feet. The Prabhupada mentions in the purport that people generally do not become devotees of Lord Vishnu, since Lord Vishnu never becomes the order supplier of his devotee. So the benedictions of Lord Vishnu are different, you know, from the others. By the mercy of Lord Vishnu, one can be completely freed from material contamination and go back home, back to Godhead. So others are temporary and limited benedictions. As a blind man being able to see accepts another blind man as his leader, people who do not know the goal of life accept someone as a guru who is a rascal and a fool. But we are interested in self-realization. Therefore, we accept you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as our spiritual master, for you are able to see in all directions and are omniscient like the sun. It says at the bottom of the paragraph there, it is the guru's business to instruct his disciple to surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead if he wants relief from the material clutches. This is the symptom of the guru. This same principle was instructed by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Yadideki Tarikaha, Krishna Upadesh. In other words, one is advised not to accept a guru who does not follow the path of instruction given by Lord Krishna. And of course, you know, we see here also that Parikshit Maharaj Parikshit Maharaj originally asked about the much incarnation from Sukadeva Goswami, and the understanding was, as it says in 4.7, that the Lord appears to protect his devotee. So Vamana Dev appeared to protect Bali Maharaj, and Parikshit Maharaj is interested to understand, you know, who did Lord Matsya appear to protect? He would have appeared for the same reason. And so this story is being told. And just as you see that there is further development in the sense that we saw in the last discussion of the incarnation of Lord Vamana Dev, we had to understand who is the false guru and who is the real guru who teaches one to surrender to the Vishnu Tattva. And then here Satchabrata is speaking philosophically on that same topic, that one should only accept a guru who teaches one to surrender to Vishnu Tattva, just as Bali Maharaj did. So there's some more continuation of that understanding. A materialistic so-called guru instructs his materialistic disciples about economic development and sense gratification, and because of such instructions, the foolish disciples continue in the materialistic existence of ignorance. But your lordship gives knowledge that is eternal, and the intelligent person receiving such knowledge is quickly situated in his original constitutional position. So Srila Prabhupada mentions that so-called gurus instruct their disciples for the sake of material profit. Well, the result is that one remains perpetually in material existence and suffers its tribulations. If one is intelligent enough to take instructions from Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita or Sankhya philosophy Kapila Dev, one can very soon attain liberation. and be situated in his original position of spiritual life. The living entity being part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead has the birthright to a position in Vaikuntha Loka, or the spiritual world, where there is no anxiety. Therefore, one should follow the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And there's that verse from Bhagavad Gita 4:9 quoted, that after giving up one's body, one will return home back to Godhead. The Lord lives in the spiritual world in his original personality, and a devotee who follows the instructions of the Lord approaches him. As a spiritual person, such a devotee returns to the personality of Godhead and plays and dances with him. That is the ultimate goal of life. My Lord, you are the supreme well-wishing friend of everyone, the dearmost friend, the controller, the supersoul, the supreme instructor, and the giver of supreme knowledge, and the fulfillment of all desires. But although you are within the heart, the foolish, because of lusty desires in the heart, cannot understand you. So, we wonder why people won't just take that knowledge and practice it. So, herein, the reason for foolishness is described. Because the conditioned soul in the material world is full of materialistic, lusty desires, he cannot understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, although the Lord is situated in everyone's hearts. It is because of this foolishness that one cannot take instructions from the Lord, although the Lord is ready to instruct everyone, both externally and internally. By mental speculation, one can understand that one is not the body but a spirit soul. But unless one engages in devotional service, the real purpose of life is never fulfilled. The real purpose of life is to go back home, back to Godhead, and live with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Play with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Dance with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And eat with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These are different items of ananda, spiritual happiness in spiritual variegatedness. Even though one may come to the platform of Brahma Buddha and understand his spiritual identity by speculative knowledge, one cannot enjoy spiritual life without understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One can fulfill the ultimate goal of life only by engaging in devotional service to the Lord. Then the Lord will give proper instructions on how to go back home, back to God. O Supreme Lord, for self-realization I surrender unto you, who are worshipped by the demigods as the supreme controller of everything. By your instructions, exposing life's purpose, kindly cut the knot from the core of my heart and let me know the destination of my life. So here King Satchabrata is showing us a way to accept the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the real spiritual master. The Supreme Lord has given full directions in Bhagavad Gita about how to deal with everything in this material world and how to return home back to Godhead. Therefore, one should not be misled by so-called gurus who are rascals and fools. Rather, one should directly see the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the guru or instructor. It is difficult, however, to understand Bhagavad Gita without the help of the Guru. Therefore, the Guru appears in the Parampara system. In Bhagavad Gita 4.34, the Supreme Personality of Godhead recommends, just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. So, as it says here, Lord Krishna directly instructed Arjuna. Arjuna is therefore Tattvadashi or Guru. Arjuna accepted the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Similarly, following in the footsteps of Sri Arjuna, well, this is what I was just saying before. I was quoting a lecture that I just recently heard, but the same thing is confirmed exactly. Similarly, following in the footsteps of Sri Arjuna, who is a personal devotee of the Lord, one should accept the supremacy of Lord Krishna, as supported by Vyas, Devala, Sita, Narada, and later by the Acharyas, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Nimbarka, and Vishnu Swami, and still later by the greatest Acharya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Where then is the difficulty in finding a guru? If one is sincere, he can find the guru and learn everything. One should take lessons from the guru and find out the goal of life. Maharaj Satyabrata therefore shows us the way of the Mahajan. One should surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and learn about him, from him, about the spiritual world and the goal of life. So we're learning from Krishna. That's the interesting thing, is that do you feel like that? You know, do you feel like that? Whatever you're learning as a devotee, you're actually being taught by Krishna. Do you? Put your hands up in this, so shall I? A little higher, yeah.
I feel like
they're being purified, mate. I've always felt, you know, I read the Bhagavad Gita before I'd ever met a devotee, and I didn't even realize devotees actually existed. I had seen from a distance some Hare Krishnas, but I didn't realize these were their books. It didn't quite, you know, dawn on me that this, you know. But from the very beginning of reading the Gita, I understood that I was hearing Krishna's message and that it was being very well presented through Srila Prabhupada. So I was learning from Krishna via the media of Srila Prabhupada, and I understood that without Prabhupada, there'd be no way that I would understand Bhagavad Gita. And even after reading the Gita and the Nectar Devotion and joining the movement, it was only then that I realized that I knew enough to want to surrender to Krishna. I knew enough that I was happy to just do that for the rest of my life. But when I joined the movement, I understood that I really had to see what the devotees were doing and, you know, take proper guidance for everything to really, you know, to get a real feel for it like that. So, you know, you imagine, you know, someone, you know, sometimes they have these descriptions of the sport that people play, like they have a description of cricket or a description of Australian rules football. and people can never understand it. You know, if you tell people from another country the game of Australian rules football, they never understand it. You can tell them the whole thing and they just can't conceive of it. And even they watch it, they just like, what is happening? Gradually, seeing, sometimes participate, gradually. Otherwise, it's very difficult to understand. So, what to speak of devotional service. So, I've always felt that from the very beginning that you're being taught by Krishna, but we're also being taught by Krishna. You're being taught by Prabhupada and his followers, but we're also being taught by Krishna himself. I've always felt that. Yeah? You feel that? See, now that's interesting to me. See, one of the things I've noticed as I've gone through devotional service is it's things that, I assume that everyone's experiencing, and after 20, 30, 40 years, I realise, no. I've always understood it from the very beginning. I've always felt that, and I've always felt his presence, and I've always felt Prabhupada's presence, and that's never left me since the day I picked up a book. So it's a nice meditation, isn't it? That Krishna is actually teaching us, each and every one of us individually. He's accompanying our spiritual life, so we have. We have our spiritual master. And this is, very important because, sometimes you see that devotees may take initiation and then there may be great distances of time or space between seeing their spiritual master, or sometimes the spiritual master departs, or sometimes it's a long time before they can choose a spiritual master that's suitable to them. The whole time, the constant factor is Krishna is always there as the spiritual master. And anytime we want to understand Krishna's teachings, what he's got to say to us, we can pick up the Gita. What have you got to say to us, Krishna? A lot. Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya telling so much Krishna's teachings. Spiritual world is like this, like that. It's all coming from Krishna.
I remember just starting to believe in Krishna when I read Arjuna's prayers in chapter 11.
So Arjun gave you confidence.
Yeah, just like his whole glorification. Like
yeah.
You are air, you are fire.
Yeah, so he said, that's right. That's, it's a very important.
Yeah.
Sometimes we miss that, that Arjun is guru. He's one of our first gurus, and he's one of our constant gurus. Today, of course, is the 50th anniversary of the mission to land men on the moon. Now, according, because when they got there, they didn't find. So, now we hear that, and we'll hear in this ninth chapter, when we do the ninth chapter, that Krishna, Lord Ramchandra is born in the dynasty coming from the sun god. And Krishna is coming from the dynasty coming from the moon god. So, Now, you know, or the presiding deity of the moon. You know, we have the presiding deity of Earth is Bhumi. But even we see in the pastimes of Pariksit Maharaj that even Bhumi was seeking protection under Pariksit Maharaj, the grandson, you know, so these here in the Gita, you know, Krishna said to Arjuna, I first instructed this Bhagavad Gita to the sun god. Now Arjuna said, I totally accept everything you've said. So we accept Arjuna as Krishna's guru and Arjuna's guru, then we all have to accept that there's a sun god. That means there's at least one person on the sun, as Krishna spoke to him, but as we know, the sun god had a son. Actually, he had several children. That means there were some children there. That means he's got to have a wife. That means he has to have a home. And because he's actually a presiding deity, he's got a whole retinue. Any king, any ruler, so many servants. And similarly on the moon. In fact, all the planets. So our understanding is that on these planets there are civilizations, and these civilizations exist throughout the universe. Yet, having gone to the moon and spent hundreds of billions of dollars over that time, the scientists have found no trace of life at all after turning up a few stones, collecting a few rocks and stones from somewhere. But that's not surprising, you see, because I think the majority of people on this planet believe that when a person dies, sometimes they exist in a spirit form or a ghost form or astral type form, and they appear before them. So most people accept that we live here. Therefore, you know, you very rarely find people who, a lot of people might go for a walk down the beach at midnight, they might go for a walk in the park even, but they don't usually go for a walk in the cemetery, even if it's a beautiful park, because they're scared of the ghost. Ghost. They won't. And I've done a few ceremonies where I've had to, you know, shoo away some nasty ghosts from, you know, different people. And they're sometimes people who didn't believe these things, and sometimes the people, you know, who understood them. But they definitely, something was causing a lot of trouble. Banging, knocking, and doing all sorts of things. And I remember one time as a teenager, I used to work at Bushrangers Bay, which is down Cape Shank. Cape Shank?
Yeah.
Mm. So as a teenager, one of the jobs I had was with the team, we put that walking path in and all the fences along that cliff line and everything. So there's big cliffs, 100 foot or something, and then it goes down to the ocean. And so because I knew that so well, because I worked there every day for, you know, throughout winter, actually, they used to drop us off there. We had a little caravan on site. We, you know, put all those walking tracks in and everything. One time I went down there with a friend at about midnight on a full moon night, and there's a part there where you're walking through the walking track where there's this gnarly old tea tree. They call it, do you know why they call it Bushrangers Bay? Because that's where the bushrangers, as one of the places they used to hide out. And people were killed there, people were murdered, people were raped. All sorts of terrible things happened down there. So there's a lot of, you know, tormented souls still hanging around. You know. Anyway, one of the bush, you're walking along the sort of the edge, but there's a gnarly old tea tree sort of tunnel, and it goes for about maybe about 50 meters. So it was a very bright full moon night. But as soon as you step into this tea tree forest, which is more like a tunnel, so it's about, you know, sort of 4 or 5 meters outside and 4 or 5 meters outside. But once you got in there, it was just dark. You almost couldn't see in front of you. And when we're outside, it was completely calm. And as soon as we walked in, the tea trees are going wild, and there's like this, you know, strong wind, all the branches all the way along, but mostly in the part we were walking. So, going back and loud sound, and as soon as we stepped out the other end, nothing. So, and actually, then I was walking along with my friend, and then basically it was very still, but as I was walking beside him, it felt like the wind, but it came up and pushed me in the backside, so that almost tripped over. I said, "Did you feel that wind?" He said, "No." But nothing for him, but it just about pushed me over. And this is why, if you ever go to mountain peaks and cliffs, don't ever stand too close to the edge, because there's ghosts and that, and they come along and they're like the wind, and they come and they push you over the edge. You know, the people are just sort of, and they just suddenly that's what they do, they push you. But don't get too close to the edge. But, you know, we can be right in the same room. People know that all over the world, with so many different subtle beings. We know they're there, right? But we can't see them because they're in subtle bodies. And you can be right there. And they can be doing all sorts of activities, and, you know, there's whole groups of them, and, you know, so many. And they have control, just like that, you know, as I walked through that tea tree forest, they, you know, had control of that forest. They were just, it was just going wild, you know. It wasn't just a subtle presence, they were physically, you know, moving them. What to speak of those who are demigods, you know, and so forth. So it is possible, you know, to be in the presence of demigods, and we wouldn't even know, we wouldn't even see them. Every day when we sit down and do the fire yajna, every day we're doing that, aren't we? All of us. Anyway, what are we doing there? Agni is there. And we're, you know, Agni is there, and Agni is accepting the offerings and passing them to Vishnu. So we do that, you know, there's cultures all over the world who do that. They can see the fire, they understand that, you know, these demigods are there, but they can't see the demigod. But we understand they're there. So many demigods are there. So, therefore, you know, we accept when Krishna says, Arjun said, "Yes, you spoke this to the sun god," then we just accept, yes. And then Krishna's guru, because none of us have ever been to the sun, and none of us will probably ever go to the sun. So the only way we'll ever know if there are people on the sun is if Krishna tells us. Otherwise, we probably would think that there's no one there. as far as Krishna says, they're there. As far as Arjuna, who actually went with Krishna to all these different places, we accept. And that same knowledge comes down to us today. So, you know, you can see that difficult for, you know, this principle of the guru you know, what to speak of living entities in a subtle body, we don't even actually look at each other. The spirit soul, we never see. We understand each and every one of us as spirit soul, we never see that at all. We just accept it's there because it's consciousness. So this is the principle of guru, but if one is if one is interested to finish that cycle of birth and death, then of course one approaches for spiritual knowledge that what is that constant existence we may have whereby we transcend that cycle of birth and death, and that comes from the guru, that spiritual understanding. Did you say you can't get a direct instruction from Prabhupada?
No, I said that you need to be purified enough to get a direct instruction from Prabhupada.
Yeah.
So if you're saying that, you know, you won't accept any of the disciples of Prabhupada, then basically what you're saying is that I don't want to listen to anyone.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, yes. Some do.
Said they have a special vision, or the ghost is allowing people to see
it.
Yeah, sometimes they, you know, the ghosts, if they desire for people to perceive them, they somehow, some of them seem to have the ability to allow people to see them, either faintly or to some degree. Or at least to perceive their presence. We know that story of Prabhupada having to drive one ghost out of the old house that he stayed in while he was riding his Bhagavatam, when he didn't know where to live, and no one would stay in that house because it was haunted, and the ghost came to annoy Srila Prabhupada, and he basically asked him to leave. So Prabhupada, you know, understood that the ghost was there and spoke to him. Don't be disturbing. So,
but if someone is murdered, say, they have to be as a ghost until the time is finished? Because it's not like they committed suicide, but they were murdered.
Yeah. People sometimes have to live in a ghostly body for a long time, and sometimes if they're particularly sinful, it's not just for the duration of when that body would have come to an end, but because of their attachment to a particular place and what have you in that particular body, and because of sinful activity, sometimes they can, you know, stay for hundreds of years, you know, generation after generation. But until someone helps them to move on. But, you know, people die in a very disturbed state of mind in the tamaguna. Then they, for different reasons, they can become, take a ghostly form. And of course, this is why there's a cremation, because by doing the cremation, it helps to cut the attachment to that body and everything related to it. So, you know, a lot of housewarmings also that I do. You know, sometimes people just sense that they want to do the purification ceremony because they feel a presence from, or they don't know, they just feel uneasy until there's been a purification, because they feel that there may be subtle beings in the house. It makes them, you know, feel rest easy from the very beginning. There was that story of the three Hindu boys were killed in a house fire in Footscray some years back, and an Asian man rang me, wanted me to do a ceremony because the house burnt down, so it ended up vacant land. But he understood that some evil influence, no matter what he did, he couldn't make any progress to develop that property. And it was just constantly things were smashing his plans. And he had a variety of different people come in to try and send those souls away, but he couldn't do it. And he tried Buddhists and this one and that one. So he called me, and I went there, and he understood these boys are here and they won't let me develop it until they've had been allowed to, you know, to purify so they can move on. And because to die in a house fire like that, that sort of tragedy is enough to make people ghosts as well. And so I noticed that this person, he had... on the ground, he had some things, like a little plate with a cup of tea, and there were some cigarettes unlit and a box of matches. And I said to him, "So, is that for you afterwards?" He said, no, I'm making an offering to the boys, you know, trying to appease them." And I said, "Oh no, the Hindu boys, well, you don't know, but that." That won't make them go away. It might make them stay, but it won't make them go away. So I got him to put that aside. Anyway, I did a ceremony, and that did the job. But then he sort of, you know, managed to develop that property. But, you know, people feel that, you know, that's the reason, you know. It's not everything. Everything else is there, but, there's some presence here that just smashes my plan. So they know, you know, something happening. And that was even on a vacant land.
There was the ghost even in the lady's apartment.
Yeah, there was one down in Bhakti Bhavan. I had to go down to the ceremony. It was a few years back as well. There's this one room there that no one, they all had trouble. Anyone who slept there had trouble. But anyway, the point being that for a lot of people don't, you know, what to speak of living entities on the moon, they won't even accept that there's other living entities like ghosts here. You know, there's some people who just will not accept it. The majority of the world, you know, they tend to accept that. You know, but you can't, generally you can't see them. But there are a few people who can perceive them directly and even communicate with them. But, you know, The easiest way is just accept from the guru, you know, someone who knows. And we accept so many things from Krishna, which the only way we're ever going to know. So that's the interesting thing about the Gita. It's such an exalted philosophy. You know, the intelligence of someone who spoke that philosophy, it is a wisdom which applies to all humankind for all time. Past, present, future, it will always apply. Dealing with, you know, controlling the mind and the senses and understanding, you know, the subtle body and the soul and the supreme soul, like that. And, but, you've got to get past that fourth chapter, where Krishna says he spoke to the sun god. For a lot of people, there's a couple of things I noticed about the Gita where people put it down, that's it. One is way in the first chapter where Srila Prabhupada talks about women. For a lot of women, that's it for me. And the other one, you know, when you come to the Krishna spoke to the sun god 40 million years ago, 440 million. So, still, what they see is that when people practice Krishna consciousness, they actually do feel the presence of the Supreme Lord guiding their lives. As you said, you actually feel him, you know, there's a supreme controller guiding their life and purifying their life and giving them spiritual strength and you know, spiritual bliss, which, you know, is not related to any sense gratification or any material thing. So, Sukadeva Goswami continued, when Satyabrata, you know, and here we are reading about 800 million mile long fish, pulling it up. When Satyabrata had thus prayed to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who had assumed the form of a fish, the Lord, while moving in the water of inundation, explained to him the absolute truth. So then, as we're hearing from Krishna, Satyabrata heard from a fish. So he's also a fish. The Supreme Personality of Godhead thus explained to King Satyabrata the spiritual science known as Sankhya Yoga, the science by which one distinguishes between matter and spirit, in other words, Bhakti Yoga. Along with the instructions contained in the Puranas, the old histories, and the Samhitas, the Lord explained himself in all these literatures. While sitting on the boat, King Satyabrata, accompanied by the great saintly persons, listened to the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in regard to self-realization. These instructions were all from the eternal Vedic literature, Brahma. Thus, the king and sages had no doubt about the absolute truth. So this Brahma, transcendental literatures, they're spiritual because they're emanating from the Lord. Sabda Brahma, the sound coming from the Vedas, the spiritual teachings. They're nothing to do with material things, the Vedas. They're not produced by men who have the four imperfections of imperfect senses, cheating propensity, commit mistakes, and become illusion. So, you know, I was seeing with the, you know, when they put the Hubble, you know, they put the Hubble telescope. It's hundreds of billions of dollars there. When they put it up into the sky, they had to make a special lens, right, which made from, you know, it's a big thing, probably about the size of this room, big lens made out one big solid piece of glass, and then they carved it, and then they had to smooth it into shape. And there's this test they do to you know, show how the light's reflecting, that you've got your surface the right shape, you're going to get the right picture. So they did the test, and then they had this precision where they're smoothing out the lens by machine to 1/1,000,000th of a centimetre, which is something like, they say, you know, if you expanded that up to the size of the Earth, the difference would be about 6 inches or something, you know, 6 centimetres or something. So the precision, you can imagine. So $50 million for that, just that one lens. And they thought, just in case, we better build another one, another $50 million, just for that. So anyway, they sent it up, got it up in space. There was a little check that they didn't do, because they tend to commit mistakes. And when they tested, you know, whether it was giving off the right light, they hadn't set the machine right by about a centimetre or two, and that meant the pictures didn't work. So it was just a little mistake. The mistake was, usually someone checks, have you set that machine to the correct setting? Just a simple thing. No, I haven't checked. No one checked. I mean, all these signs, $50 million. So then what they had to do is, they spent so many years then, they had to work out how we fix this thing up in space. We should have sort of. These are the rocket scientists. When someone says, "I'm no rocket scientist," take it as a compliment. So then it takes some years, millions and millions of dollars. I have to get up there and walk about in space to, you know, correct the lenses and things like that. They finally fixed it. So, you know, it's $100 million, you know, mistake. So the Vedas are not written by those sorts of people. Nor are they understood by those sorts of people. And of course, you know, I looked at the astrology for the day they supposedly walked on the moon. Now, you know, if you had to
do... Where was the moon place?
What's that?
Where was the moon place?
No, from Earth time.
Yeah, I mean, like, because they wanted to walk on the moon, was the moon favourable in?
Yeah, now, actually the moon was sort of changing signs, which is, so, you know, the moon was very weak in that regard. It was about the subtlety of the bright. But Mercury was combust fully. Mercury is the planet which deals with communication, and so in other words, anyone expecting to receive proper information on that day would be let down. You know, so generally if, or cheated. You know, sometimes we have those days where all the computer's down, Facebook goes down, you know, face chat goes down, whatever they call that. I don't even use these things, so, you know. And the banks go down, and, you know, this goes down. And, you know, the communication, oh, I can't get through, I can't get my information, I don't know what, you know, is going on. You know, the trains go down. You know, is the train coming? No one's even telling, you know. There's anything that's, you know, moving people or things from one place to another, including knowledge and communication, it's a mess. So that was the day That the world received the information about the moon. Rahu and Ketu were also changing signs. So they become extremely, you know, a weak malefic becomes very powerful in giving its harmful effects. So that influence of everything being covered over, you know, what you're seeing, there's something on the outside, but what you want to see, you can't see. It's covered over by other things, you know. And then you've got all these different, you know, somehow, because I mentioned, you know, I think they have a movie on tonight, The Dish, and then after that, they put on some documentary or something about the moon landing and stuff like that. But whenever you see the documentaries, it's all this stuff, oh, you know, and there's the astronaut's wife, and, you know, she's waving goodbye, and there's the people waving up there. You know, they go for hours, all this sort of stuff. But, you know, where the crucial bits, hang on, you jump something there, you know, what happened then? Oh, there's this big black picture. Oh, that's them landing, is it? That big black thing there? Oh, that's them landing. Oh, that's the actual movie of them landing. Oh, I see, yeah. I would have liked to see more of that bit of dust coming up with something, you know. So all those bits, you know, where the rocket separates, where the Hubble, not the Hubble, but the Eagle.
Apollo.
What's that?
Apollo.
Yeah, where it separates from the rocket, you know, because they supposedly, the rocket stayed in orbit and they supposedly got the lunar landing module. And they had to attach that, you know, they had to pull it out from the rocket or something and then attach it to another rocket and then move it into position, and that went down and then that come up and stuff like that. And, you know, there's all those sort of... And then as they're beaming that, America, you know, they communicate... Oh, they say this, that the astronauts, they were going to do the moon landing 4 hours later, but they decided, no, let's do it now. And so, oh, we better get everything up and running. So, you know, somehow or another, you know, then Australia managed to cut in, and Australia got the footage. You know, they, oh, yeah, we just got it. Oh, there they are. They just happened to be landing there. So, oh, you know, there's a lot cut out, you know, while supposedly they switched from America to Australia. And so many different things. There's so many anomalies and so much you don't see. It's quite possible they buzzed around the moon. Whether they actually landed on the moon is highly debated. If someone, you know, I'd probably go as far as to accept that they went around. They may have orbited and come back. I could understand them having to actually, you know, while a rocket is hovering in the orbit or rotating, whatever it is, and then for that lunar landing module, it's got to detach, come down, and they had, what, 10 seconds to spare of fuel or something like that, you know, to get down, and then they have another part which has just enough thrust to get them up. And that's got to get them all the way exactly to where that rocket is and connect up, and then that's got to get all the way back. There's so many parts, all those intricate parts, the impossible parts. You know, I mean, even doing that around the Earth, very difficult. There's a lot of parts missing, I'm very doubtful, because one of the things Prabhupada says is that one of the things that even the scientists admit is that in the lunar day, which means the bright phase, which lasts about 2 weeks, the temperatures well exceed 100 degrees Celsius. Not Fahrenheit, Celsius. And in the lunar... What's that? And in the lunar night, it well exceeds 150 degrees minus Celsius. Now you go down to Antarctica, you get about 37, 40, you know, you get to 50 like that. Now, The space, the lunar landing module, they had to get it up there, they had to make it so thin. It was so thin, they showed a piece of the metal, it was like tinfoil. It was actually metal, and it was as thin as tinfoil. Special metal, but to keep the weight down. Right? That was the difference between them on the outside of space, and this is, you know, way up near the moon. How they protected themselves at that distance from the Earth, where you're getting closer to the sun and you're in those sort of temperatures, from the temperatures, that's what Prabhupada says, how they can actually, in those suits, you know, exist in those temperatures when the scientists themselves are saying that's what the temperatures are. And you see them. You know, nothing's fogging up or anything in their things. You know, you know, even when you hear them speaking, there is, you know, it's like a sunny day. It's like, you know, they're just, yeah, it's great. We're having a ball out here, bouncing around. Who bounces around the middle of the Sahara Desert? Or in Antarctica? In those extreme temperatures, everything is just your mobility. Right? And then the other thing that struck me was that, because I watched it, when they spoke to them from here, they'd ask them a question, the astronauts would immediately answer. And I'm thinking, hang on, I, this is 2019. If you watch the news, someone's in London and the news presenters ask them a question and they wait. Yeah, certainly. There's about 5 to 10 seconds gap. And this is 1969. They're on the moon. Someone's talking to them here, they're just bang. It's a straight reply. But there's something sus to me. There's something very sus about that. How that sound could be just, you know, to the degree that we don't have today. They don't even have it today, that sort of level. You know, sound and light take a long time to travel. So, you know, I'm highly doubtful that they landed. They may have, you know, slingshotted around or whatever they did, but... Well, yes, in one sense that it's by the orbits, you know. From what I understand, that the sun is orbiting around the Earth like this, from the scientific perspective, but the moon is on a higher orbit, so it's higher, but the sun's further around, so... It's higher from that perspective, straight up. And the moon is past that. The
moon is further 1.2 million.
Yeah.
It's 94.2 million miles away from the Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's... there's a lot of things which need... verification.
Another thing, I think they haven't gone to the moon ever since. That was the only time.
No, I think they apparently they went six times.
I mean, they did not land the moon. Prabhupada said in one lecture. Then where did they land? The question raises. You know?
Prabhupada said possibly Arizona.
Dark planet.
He says, one said it could have been it could have been Rahu or it could have been the Arizona desert.
Because the moon is considered as a heavenly planet.
Yeah.
So with this material body, nobody can get there.
Yeah.
That's what
So, you know, we do have, you know, there is certain scientific knowledge and what have you, but there's a lot of anomalies. I think they did go back. Apparently they went back and they had a lunar buggy and all sorts of things. But people lost interest.
Yeah.
People didn't care.
A lot of controversies on the, if you can browse it on Google.
Yeah.
And when the person, they were landing on the planet, I don't know, wherever they did land, they're having some kind of four shadows beside them.
Yeah.
So it's pitch dark out there, and
they're
having some kind of four shadows around them. So there's this one.
These
are people that are non-believers of landing on moon. They're raising up this question. So
yeah, that's right.
There's
a lot of anomalies. Yeah, there's a lot of anomalies. I mean, they have their excuses, but basically there's a lot of anomalies. And, you know, they went up to, who was it, Buzz, one of them, was it Buzz Aldrin? That someone went up to him with the Bible, said, "You swear in the Bible that you stepped foot on the moon." Did you see that? And he wouldn't do it. And then he kept pressing him. And then the astronaut, you know, the first one, put his, he just, bang, he smashed this guy in the face. I saw that. I've seen it a couple of times. He wouldn't, you know, he's saying, "Swear in the Bible, get out of here, get out of here." He said, "No, you swear in the Bible, you said for the..." Bang. Anyway, that sort of person, can we trust? You know, someone says, "Prabhupada, did you preach in Hawaii? Get out of here. Did you preach in Hawaii?" So, now, the other interesting thing is that it's the, what is the benefit? Now, of course, you know, we're told that the benefit here, it describes that one of the main reasons that people are not interested in the spiritual topic is because they're just interested in sense gratification. Let's just put that whole Christian thing aside. We'll just debunk it in so many different ways. So, what was I going to say? Oh, this sense gratification. Basically, these moon missions, you know, it's like basically the government gets money. And what they really want is better weapons and, you know, a better future, you know, that, you know, don't worry what we do to this planet, there are others. and sense gratification, you know, a lot of monopolizing sense gratification and making a lot of profit by through sense gratification. Now, all of the science that goes into these, so when it comes to the, you know, the cameras that they have to use that work in space and different temperatures, whether it comes to the, you know, miniaturizing things, you know, to fit in a rocket, the computers, everything, all of that, all the people who work on those, most of them, then they branched out into business where, you know, the great over 10, 20 years, whatever they're doing to get some rocket into space, they get these great computers and understanding, that then becomes a business for them. These things all become commercial business, both for government, private, all over the world. All of it, the sense, you know, the all the paraphernalia of sense gratification that we have today, a lot of those things come directly from what they, the billions that they're allowed to spend at such places like NASA doing such things. Billions and billions of dollars. So now, on the day that they actually launched the Apollo 11 to the moon, a whole lot of the, you know, African American, I'm not sure what you're supposed to call them, what you're not supposed to call them now, it just sounds like you get in trouble, whatever you say. I say African American, let's hope I don't cause any offense, but anyway. Is that what you call them?
Yeah.
Good, okay. they went there with all their hungry families, protesting that we're struggling to eat. We live in America, we're struggling to eat. We're speaking to people all over the world. We don't want you sending these rockets. You know, you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars. Could you just spend a little and just feed us right here? So, but if you said to the if you said to the government anywhere in the world that there's a pressing issue for the people of this world to have their basic necessities met all over the world, and the governments was they have their projects, you know, so there may be, let's say there's $50 billion and the people want it. Well, we need it. Well, but if we spend this $50 billion and get a closer look at that star 300 light years from now, we may know where this earth came from, and those scientific advancements will make your life so much better. So then the people, yeah, spend like that. So it's like, you know, they the governments are allowed to spend billions and billions and billions of dollars and deprive people of their daily necessities who go their entire life and suffer, and the governments, you know, people will allow them. Oh, okay. So if people get tired of the moon, oh, we don't want to give to NASA anymore. Ah, oh, that's it, we're going to Mars. Oh, Mars? Oh, well, let's double what we gave last time. Mars, very interesting. It's red, is it? The other one was white, this one reddish. So, you know, there's a lot of cheating. There's a lot of, you know, illusory sort of things going on. There's a lot of disinformation, misinformation. As I said, the astrology chart that I did for the day that they supposedly landed on the moon, you know, if you, you know, any astrologer looked at that would think something shifty is really going on a real big scale. You know, a real shifty is going on here. So, so it comes down to whether we trust Arjun as a guru, the Krishna, I accept everything you've said. You spoke to the sun god. You come from the moon dynasty. This, you know, you yourself saying that all these demigods exist and that they are manifestations of your energy. And they're all there. There are ghosts. There are pitas. There is this. There is that. We accept that as truth. There is Airavata, you know, the great lord, the elephant. Uchaisrava. So many things. I accept all these things exist for
giant mangoes.
What's that?
Giant mangoes without
pits. Giant mangoes, Timmingilla fish, birds that fly from planet to planet that eat, they, you know, big enough to eat an elephant. So it's who you accept as a guru. So we accept Krishna. Okay, so any other questions or comments about the moon? Or no, we're good. While sitting on the boat, King Satyabrata, accompanied by great saintly persons, listened to the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in regard to self-realizations. These instructions were all from the eternal Vedic literature, Brahma, spiritual. Thus, the king and sages had no doubt about the absolute truth. So they had no doubt. At the end of the last inundation, yep.
Just one quick question.
Yes.
Now, yeah, yes, Krishna came as much as we know that now. Mm. But for suppose the fish, the fish becoming big, it could be a mystic yogi too. How could he be sure that it was Krishna? A mystic yogi can do that easily.
800 million miles.
Yeah.
That'd be a pretty good yogi.
Because they could become small, they could become big. The way they describe they can become small, they can become big. They can walk on water. They can do quite a few things when you read about all those mystic things that they can do.
Except that they're scared of water. when it's in the quantities of the inundation. Therefore, generally, when the inundation is there, they go up to the Brahmaloka. It's said that, you know, even though some of the lower planetary systems, the Siddhaloka and that, don't get inundated during these type of inundations, it's such a ferocious, you know, terrible event that they go all the way up there because of the anxiety, the fear that this sort of event, you know, it's a massive, powerful event, you know. So they're all the greatest yogis. You know, you have to be a great yogi to go up there. So none of them stay. The only one we know that was there was Satyabrata, and whoever was on, lucky enough to be on that boat with him. And even, you know, Markandeya Rishi, which we'll hear of, he was also a great yogi, but you know, by Krishna's potency, he also saw the inundation, but he was there for millions of years, and he didn't see another person.
Did he suffer also? He found it very difficult.
He found it very difficult, yeah. And he was also a great yogi. So no, there's no, they can't become a fish 800 miles long and just swim about in the ocean. That, even those great yogis, this is millions and millions of years, they can't manage. There's nothing there.
No, now we know that because of that. But before the devastating waters came, and this is, you can't be, you have to be Lord Vishnu because you're becoming so big. So he had prayed to the Lord. So he had recognized before the devastating water came that it was Lord Vishnu. That is before. So how did he do that? That's my
question. Yeah, because of the extent of his size and power, you know, it was, he understood that this fish had unlimited potencies, but he, you know, he could immediately expand himself to the capacity that Satyabrata could provide with no trouble at all. And
so that could not have been done by a mystic yogi?
No, his ability to, you know, was unlimited. That's what Satyabrata perceived. There was no limitation, and it was, you know, basically the biggest ocean that Satyabrata, you know, could provide, which he couldn't even provide, the Lord had to provide it himself, was the ocean of inundation. So, you know, it's just beyond even what the yogis can do. It was just unlimited, immediate, no effort.
Because he was a devotee as well? He was not fooled by, the devotee is not fooled by false powers? But
yeah, he certainly wasn't accepting you know, false, as he says here, he wasn't the sort of person who would accept even a great demigod as a guru, or, you know, like that. And the demigods can sometimes do, you know, quite wondrous things. Or even the demons, he wasn't going to accept one of them as a guru. And they can sometimes do wondrous things. But none of them, neither the demigods, the demons, or great mystics, you know, had could compare to, now of course, you know, Satyabrata was the son of the sun god, so he's not someone without experience of the great powers that be within the universe. So he understood what even the greatest of demigods and mystic yogis are capable of, being the son of the sun god. You got a good, you know, bird's eye view of the universe, yeah, that the sun is the eye of the universe. So what he was perceiving with Lord Matsya was, you know, beyond anything that's capable within the universe. So he, you know, he was in a position to be able to compare that. Mm.
Or did Krishna give him the special ability to recognize?
Well, he had that facility as well. And, you know, for instance, Arjuna, we do know that he accepted Krishna because he was a devotee, and as such a brother, he accepted Matsya because he was a devotee. But we also appreciate that if anyone, you know, this devotional sentiment of such a brata can't be taken cheaply, because he was also in the position where he could perceive everyone else in the universe, what's capable. And similarly, Arjuna, he accompanied Krishna through so many events. Arjuna saw, you know, he was, you know, born from Indra. You know, he had association with different demigods. There was no one to compare. You know, he had also a bird's eye view to compare Krishna between everyone else. Therefore, when, you know, one may reject Arjuna, oh, he had some personal sentiment for Krishna. But actually, you know, Prabhupada mentions himself that Arjuna knew Krishna so well. You know, he was his friend. He was an intimate associate. Who, you know, he had the opportunity to know Krishna and to, you know, see him compared to anyone else and understand, well, you know, what I understand through my devotional service is, you know, also perceivable in my life with Krishna. And so Satyabrata is the son of the sun god, you know, no one can doubt their sentiment. No one can doubt their bhakti. It's the bhakti by which they understand Krishna. But, you know, so for instance, say we take the Noah's Ark. So in Judaism, in Christianity, well, actually even a lot of Christians don't accept these, you know, what they would think sort of fables of the Bible. They're there for instruction, but you don't have to accept that they really existed. But some do. Some do. Oh, yes, there was Noah's Ark and so many things. So, but if you say to them that, yes, there was Noah's Ark, and the Lord appeared as a big fish to guide that ark through those flood waters. Oh, no, that can't be.
Who's Noah's
Ark? Noah's Ark?
Yeah.
You don't know Noah's Ark?
I've heard the name, but
I've never. Oh, so it's from the Bible. There was an inundation in the, you know, the Old Testament, and the whole world was also flooded, and all you could see is water. Was it 7 days and seven nights, or 14 days and nights? I can't remember how long.
I didn't study that.
No, yeah, it was a big inundation. But everything, all land, the whole thing, the whole earth, covered. And Noah was asked to, you know, build an ark. He had to build it. Such a brother. Krishna provided one for him, but Noah had to build his own. And they put two of every kind of animal on, and a whole bunch of pious people, and they, you know, gradually found land, and, you know, the water subsided. So he was saved, and everyone else in the world was killed. So they accept that. Oh, yes, no, it's in the Bible. You know, God can arrange these things, a flood that covers the whole world. If you say that God appeared in the form of a fish, you know, to protect that ark in such devastating floods, because I don't know that Noah was actually a boat builder by trade. You know, so I mean, he probably got a good design. He's probably got a good design from someone. God's probably pointed him in the right direction. But that's a big inundation that floods the whole world. So that's a pretty sturdy boat. But anything could go wrong. He was basically he was on his own. But if you say, no, God accompanied Satchabrata to make sure that the boat was steady right through, no, that can't happen. But if there's bhakti, if there's a little bhakti, one can understand. Well, you know, by degrees of bhakti, we have a better understanding of God. It's revealed to us. If God is unlimited, if he knows the flood's coming, so yes, okay, God knows the flood's coming, so Noah, you're going to have to build an ark. And the flood comes and he saves Noah, but that's the limit. He's God, but he can't do any more than that. That's already enough. That's already too much for us to believe. So God is unlimited. Someone with bhakti, they understand, they're taking it from the spiritual point of view that he's the control of the whole material energy. Understand unlimited, they have a far greater understanding of God and his energies. So then if he appears as a fish, yeah, that's, you know, so it, because of the different levels of bhakti. So bhakti, by bhakti, the proper understanding of God is there. Actually, basically in this world, even people who follow religion have no concept of God. Very little. You know, some material understanding, very limited concept of God, that yes, God can do this wonderful thing or this wonderful thing, but as soon as you present an unlimited aspect to what God can do, not even unlimited, but just, you know, more, greater, no, we stop here. Okay, we stop right here. So with bhakti, you don't stop. So for instance, even the scientists, now what to speak of Noah's Ark, if you told them about much of the fish, those same religious people wouldn't accept it. But God can't do that. And God's not a fish. God, you know, no one can be 800 million, was it 800 million or billion? 800 million miles long, right? Now apparently the moon is 386,000 kilometres, right? The sun is what? 93 million. So this fish was almost all the way to the sun, right?
Is it?
And this was bigger, 800 million.
No,
80. 80?
8 million.
8 million, okay, 8. So and that's 93. So he's about, what's that?
10, 12 times bigger.
Yeah, so about a tenth the way to the sun. The moon's about 380 something, according to their thousand. So this is a big fish. So they can't conceive of that. So now the scientists, they won't accept any of that. They won't accept Noah's Ark. You know, Noah lived for 700 years. No, that's not going to happen. And much of the fish and Vasuki, no, the waters of inundation, none of that. But Einstein has a, you know, if you do the mathematical equation for relativity of how, you know, energy and space and time all work, when you do the maths to its full extent, which Einstein did, you come to this conclusion that if you take the mass, that volume of mass, like say millions and millions of stars, and you get all that mass and you condense it to one single point, then the energy and gravity force, etc., the attractive force of that is unlimited. And therefore they have these, within the universe, as these black holes, which are precisely that, that's what they say. This condensed, you know, masses of like stars condensed into this one little point of singularity, they call it. When they say, when a scientist says to a point of singularity, they'll say that means we don't know what it is. But it's condensed to something. What goodness is what is that? But these are the black holes, and they now, you know, with the Hubble scopes and everything, they've got the pictures now of, which costs hundreds of billions of dollars, of these holes in space, and the you can see the light disappearing into nothing, you know. So anything that comes around that just disappears and never exists again. Go on, just sucked into it like that. As it has a gravity force that's just sucking in, you know, everything that comes like that. So these are called the black hole. Right? So here is a point which has, you know, a single point from which there is unlimited power. That's the mathematical infinity. The power of this is infinity. So they will, therefore they're trying to prove that and find the black holes because they understand that's how the maths works. But if you tell them there is a spiritual point of singularity which has unlimited potency and attractive force, oh no, that can't happen. If you say to the scientist, you know, the soul lives forever, no, that can't happen. You say, where does matter come from? Oh, it's always been there.
Sorry?
It's always been there. You know, their concept of the material energy from which, you know, their concept is it's always been there. If you say the soul is eternal, no. And nor can God or anyone be eternal. If you say, where does the matter come from? It's always been there, which makes it eternal. So, it's always been there, and it always will be, because of the conservation of energy. So, you add bhakti. You're talking about the same principles. Right? You're actually talking about a point of singularity with unlimited energy on a material platform, and they say, yes. That would be good for our sense gratification. We can harness that. We can do something with that. That's going to spin a lot of money. You know, there's something in that. There's energy. We understand that energy. We can control that energy, and then we got power. We got control. All right? The exact same thing, point of singularity, there it is in Krishna, but no sense gratification. Not interested. Not interested. Doesn't exist. Couldn't exist. But it's the same thing. Spirit exists eternally, not interested. Why is that? Because we have these, this is our place of sense gratification. If we're going to exist anywhere for sense gratification, you're going to be here in this material world. So it comes back, therefore, it comes back to what you're saying, this point of envy and sense gratification, that they accept the same thing. Like, you know, we say, if you know, if you do some activities for Krishna, like we're hearing about matcha, so we're hearing, it'll destroy all your karma and purify your existence, and you'll realize your spiritual identity and go about the spiritual world. So all our activities are dedicated to the Supreme Lord, Krishna. So when we dance, we dance for Krishna. We say, if you dance and you dance for Krishna, you'll become free from your karmic reactions. You'll realize, you'll become self-realized, God-realized. You'll understand everything, you know, nicely, and you'll be happy and blissful at that. You'll live longer, you know, you'll have more money, you'll have a better wife, better husband, lots of kids. Anyway. And then they say, not interested. They say, but we will dance but we must dance in the nightclubs to the boogie woogie, you know, with the girls and the boys and the drink and the alcohol. For Sanskrit, that we will do. So it's the same thing. No one's asking to do anything except they're not being asked to accept any even philosophical principles which are different. They accept they're searching out after the same philosophical principle. All the activities are the same, but the one thing is if there's bhakti there, bhakti means there's love rather than envy. And if there's no bhakti, which means there's envy rather than love, then the exact same thing they'll reject. And the whole philosophy and everything that goes along with them. That's what here is being said. They'll accept inconceivable things which they can't prove scientifically and which may take millions of years to prove or which may always be unprovable. But it's part of what they want to accept, even though it's inconceivable and it doesn't even make sense. And yet something which can be proved, they'll not accept it because of the sense. So if we say that, you know, when the soul leaves the body, there's no life, therefore it's the soul that's giving consciousness to the body, and when that soul leaves the body, all the elements are there, the soul is gone. That those sort of principles which can be, you know, verified, you know, in so many different ways, intellectually, put into practice in one's life, so many different things that they won't accept. At the end of the last inundation during the period of Svayambhuva Manu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead killed the demon named Hayagriva and delivered all the Vedic literatures to Lord Brahma when Lord Brahma awakened from sleeping. So that was the first appearance of Matsya.
At that time, the Vedas were not written down. So how can you steal the Vedas?
No, they emanated from the mouth of Brahma. And he, you know, tried to take them.
They were like personalities.
What's that?
They were like personalities.
Hayagriva.
No, the Vedas.
Yeah, they have their, that's right, yeah. They're very subtle, personal form, isn't it? But they were kidnapped, let's put it that way. So. King Satyavrata was illuminated with all Vedic knowledge by the mercy of Lord Vishnu. And in this period, he has now taken birth as Vaivasvata Manu, the son of the sun god. Oh yeah, so actually he took birth as the son of the sun god after that. So King Satyavrata. So it describes here in the purport, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti the Kaur gives his verdict that Satyavrata appeared in the Chakshusha Manvantara. When the Chakshusha Manvantara ended, the period of the Vaivasvata Manu began. By the grace of Lord Vishnu, Satyavrata received instructions from the second fish incarnations and was enlightened in all spiritual knowledge. So, you know, there is actually a. So, described there that in this period, It has now taken birth as Vaivasvata Manu, the son of the sun god. Taken birth. So, because taking birth from a demigod is a, you know, a different than how it's done here on earth. Don't they just appear fully grown?
I think so.
As far as I understand, they just, yeah, that's what I've heard.
I remember you once joking on that. It's what?
Right, yeah, they just appear. So the taking birth is almost like, it's almost like changing form and appearing in their family. But it's not like that they have birth here. So. This story concerning the great king Satyabrata and the fish incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu is a great transcendental narration. Anyone who hears it is delivered from the reactions of sinful life. One who narrates this description of the Matcha incarnation in King Satyabrata will certainly have all his ambitions fulfilled, and he will undoubtedly return home back to Godhead. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who pretended to be a gigantic fish, who restored the Vedic literature to Lord Brahma when Lord Brahma awakened from sleep, and who explained the essence of Vedic literature to King Satyabrata and the great saintly persons. Purport. Here is a summary of Satyabrata's meeting the fish incarnation of Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu's purpose was to take back all the Vedic literatures from the demon Hayagriva and restore them to Lord Brahma. Incidentally, by his causeless mercy, the Lord spoke with Satyabrata. The word Satyabratanam is significant because it indicates that those on the level of Satyabrata can take advantage from the Vedas delivered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right, so Satyabratanam. So that very word by which his name comes indicates those who can take knowledge from the Vedas delivered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Satyabrata. They can receive the truth, reality. Whatever is spoken by the Supreme Lord is accepted as Veda. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, Vedanta Kriyat Veda Vid. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the compiler of all Vedic knowledge, and he who knows the purport of the Vedas. Therefore, anyone who takes knowledge from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, or from the Bhagavad Gita as it is, knows the purpose of the Vedas. One cannot understand Vedic knowledge from the Vedavada Ratas, who read the Vedas and misconstrue their subject matter. One has to know the Vedas from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 8th canto, 24th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Matcha, the Lord's Fish Incarnation. So it says here, this commentation has been finished in our New Delhi centre today, the 1st of September 1976, the day of Radhastami, by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the Acharyas. Srila Narottam Das Thakur says, Tandira charana sevi bhakta sane vasa janame janame haya e abhis.
Oh, thank you. Is that my?
I am attempting to present to present Srimad Bhagavatam in the English language by the order of my spiritual master, Srimad Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakura. And by his grace, the work of translation is gradually progressing. And the European and American devotees who have joined the Krishna consciousness movement are helping me considerably. Thus we have expectations of finishing the great task before my passing away. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. That is the end of the eighth canto. And of course, you can see here how the Lord protecting the devotee who is interested in that essence of Vedic knowledge and protecting that Vedic knowledge itself. The Lord appears as Matsya and various different incarnations, and so you can see within Srila Prabhupada's statement here such a great task he has to finish the Bhagavatam so nicely before he leaves his body, and he's depending very heavily upon the mercy of Krishna who performs these pastimes as much and depending on Radharani. So you see that one who serves Krishna, that Srimati Radharani becomes very dear to one.
What is that phrase? Tandera Vaishnava Seva Bhakta Sanevasa.
Tandera Charana Sevi Bhakta Sanevasa Janami Janami Hoya E Abhilash.
My only desire is to always be at the lotus feet of the Vaishnavas.
Yeah.
How does it translate to?
Yeah.
Is that from one of Narottama Das Thakur's songs?
Narottama Das Thakur, yeah. But you see what Prabhupada was doing on Radhastami. He was finishing his commentation on the story of Lord Matsya. And you know, I heard a class the other day, Prabhupada, on Radhastami, and the majority of it was about that verse, Chaturvanam Vayatmayasvasa, about you know, Krishna, Bhagavad Gita 4:13, that Krishna made those Varnasram system. And yet we have to try and understand Krishna, who's above the Varnasram, try and understand, just as we're trying to understand Krishna, how he can appear as, you know, Lord Matsya, act in relationship to his devotees, to protect his devotees, and make arrangements for his devotees like this. So Srila Prabhupada on Radhastami, he was speaking that verse, and of course gradually you know, he explains that if we can understand Krishna, then immediately we transcend all material designations in the Varnasram or any other designation, and we come to our eternal spiritual platform where we can then engage in spiritual activities, loving pastimes with the personality of Godhead, and that those loving pastimes are not material, such as the activities of Radharani and the gopis with Krishna. That we see that Prabhupada mentioned Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was a very, very strict sannyasi, who renounced everything, had a beautiful wife, very influential. Hundreds of thousands of people would, you know, come to him at his request in a moment. Very, very knowledgeable, very beautiful personality. And at the age of 24, he gave up everything to absorb himself in the pastimes of Radha and Krishna and to teach those pastimes of the spiritual world to everyone through the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And Prabhupada mentions also that the six Goswamis are very, very renounced, very, very renounced. But they were also absorbed in those pastimes of Radha and Krishna. So, you know, he discussed that. Most of his lecture is about the, you know, this principle of understanding how Krishna is above the designations. Even though he appears in a human form, he's not, you know, part of the any material designation. And if we can understand that point of Krishna, we can immediately then, that allows us to understand that any activity done in relationship with Krishna is also transcendental, and that all the activities, such as the gopis, which are considered the highest loving, you know, highest, the form of worship, which conceived by the gopis, is the greatest form. The highest form of loving pastimes for the Supreme Lord. So first we must understand Krishna being transcendental. From there we can understand that any activity in relationship with Krishna is transcendental. From there we can enter into the pastimes of you know, Krishna, Braja, Krishna. All these different sections of the Bhagavatam are helping us to understand how it's possible for Krishna to be a person and yet by his energies to manifest the material worlds, to enter within the material worlds and demonstrate his pastimes, his different avatars and his Krishna himself, and yet still always remain the personality of Godhead. So this is all of these different cantos bring us to the point where we have the proper understanding that when we read the Braja Vasi, you know, the Vrindavan pastimes, we understand, yes, we are hearing about God displaying a manifestation of how he enjoys with his personified spiritual potencies, and we can enter into that. That's how we will hear it when we get to that point then. That's what this study allows. And you know, one shouldn't jump into that prematurely. So we can also pray to Lord Matsya, because we also have a big task, don't we? We've got 8 cantos under our belt, and we have to get 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th all completed successfully, among other things. So we also pray to Lord Matsya. I have Lord Sankarsan here. Sankarsan, of course, Sankarsan is the source of all manifestations, all expansions and avatars. From Sankarsan comes Lord Narayan and all his unlimited forms who appear as avatars. And the 3 Purusha avatars, Guna avatars, all the avatars, they all descend from Lord Sankarsan. So I always like to have the Sankarsan there. Okay, so that concludes the 8th canto. Any questions or comments about that? We've got 15 minutes. A very short chapter in this so you're all free of sin, and we're all going back to Godhead. This is a very short chapter. It's just, there's mostly stories, so I'm going to read it. This King Sujumna becomes a woman. King Prakrit said, "My dear Lord, Sukadeva Goswami, you have elaborately described all the periods of the various Manus and, within those periods, the wonderful activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has unlimited potency. I am fortunate to have heard all this from you." So we've heard successively all the Manus up to this one. And we also know who's coming in the future. Satchabrata, the saintly king of Dravidadesh, who received spiritual knowledge at the end of the last millennium by the grace of the Supreme, later became Vivisvata Manu, the son of Vivisvan, in the next Manvatara period of Manu. "I have received this knowledge from you. I also understand that such kings as Ikshvaku were his sons, as you have already explained. O greatly fortunate Sukadeva Goswami, O great Brahmana, kindly describe to us separately the dynasties and characteristics of all those kings, for we are always eager to hear such topics from you. Kindly tell us about the abilities of all the celebrated kings born in the dynasty of Vivisvata Manu, including those who have already passed, those who may appear in the future, and those who exist in presence." Sudha Goswami said, "When Sukadeva Goswami, the greatest knower of religious principles, was thus requested by Maharaj Parikit in the assembly of all the scholars learned in Vedic knowledge, he then proceeded to speak. Sukadeva Goswami continued, 'O King, subduer of your enemies, now hear from me in great detail about the dynasty of Manu. I shall explain as much as possible, although one could not say everything about it even in hundreds of years. The transcendental supreme person, the supersoul of all living entities, who are in different statuses of life, high and low, existed at the end of the millennium, when neither this manifested cosmos nor anything else but him existed. Right, so at this point, the whole world has been inundated. Only the personality of Godhead exists and nothing else. So we're going to hear how one thing is created one after another. O King Prakrit, from the navel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead was generated a golden lotus on which the four-faced Lord Brahma took his birth. So this is going right back. So this is the inundation, of course, going right back to the before the first Manu in this day of Brahma. So this is being summarized. From the mind of Lord Brahma, Marichi took birth, and from the semen of Marichi, Kashyapa appeared from the womb of the daughter of Daksha Maharaj. From Kashyapa, by the womb of a deity, Vivisvan took birth. There you go. Vivisvan, that's the sun god. So he's born of Kashyapa. O King, the best of the Bharat dynasty, from Vivisvan, by the womb of Samgya, Shatadev Manu was born. Shatadev Manu, having conquered his senses, begot 10 sons in the womb of his wife Shraddha. So that's, he was previously Satchabrata. Right? Satchabrata, also known as Shatadev, also known as Vivisvata. The names of these sons were Ikshvaku, Nriga, Shariyati, Dishta, Drishta, Kurushaka, Narishanta, Prasadra, Nabaga, and Kavi. Manu at first had no sons, therefore, in order to get a son for him, the great saint Vasistha, who was very powerful in spiritual knowledge, performed a sacrifice to satisfy the demigods Mitra and Varuna. During the sacrifice, Shraddha, Manu's wife, who was observing the vow of subsisting only by drinking milk, approached the priest offering the sacrifice, offering obeisance to him, and begged for a daughter. Told by the chief priest, "Now offer oblations," the person in charge of oblations took clarified butter to offer. He then remembered the request of Manu's wife and performed the sacrifice while chanting the word Prasad. Manu had begun that sacrifice for the sake of getting a son, but because the priest was diverted by the request of Manu's wife, a daughter named Ila was born. Upon seeing the daughter, Manu was not very satisfied. Thus he spoke to his guru, Vasistha, as follows. So as Prabhupada says, he was pleased at the birth of a child, later, however, was not very satisfied to see a daughter instead of a son. Because he had no issue, he was certainly very glad of the birth of Ila, but his pleasure was temporary. So he also needs a son, because that's the Vedic process. My Lord, all of you are expert in chanting the Vedic mantras. How then has the result been opposite to the one desired? This is a matter for lamentation. There should not have been such a reversal of the results of the Vedic mantras. Now, here described in this age, the performance of Jagya has been forbidden because no one can properly chant the Vedic mantras. If Vedic mantras are chanted properly, the desire for which a sacrifice is performed must be successful. Therefore, the Hare Krishna chant is called the Maha Mantra, the great exalted mantra above all other Vedic mantras. Because simply chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra brings so many beneficial effects, as explained by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Shishastika 1. Therefore, the best performance of Jagya given to us is the Sankirtan Jagya. Those who are intelligent take advantage of the greatest Jagya in this age by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. When the Hare Krishna mantra is chanted by many men together, the chanting is called Sankirtan, and as a result of such a yajna, there will be clouds in the sky. At present there are droughts throughout Europe and America and people are suffering, but if people take the Krishna consciousness movement seriously, they stop their sinful activities and chant Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, all their problems will be solved without difficulty. In other processes of Jagya, there are difficulties because there are no learned scholars who can chant the mantras perfectly well, nor is it possible to secure the ingredients to perform the Jagya. Because human society is poverty stricken and men are devoid of Vedic knowledge and the power to chant the Vedic mantras, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is the only shelter. People should be intelligent enough to chant it. So basically, performance of Jagya. So therefore, you know, when Srila Prabhupada was once asked about, you know, performance of fire Jagya and samskaras, you know, considering that it's not, you know, a process followed in Sankirtan, Prabhupada said, yes, we do, but the minimum. So in the same way that, you know, deity worship of the Lord is, you know, actually not properly possible, you know, in the same way that Jagyas are not possible, actually the full method of deity worship in all opulence and with the mantras and purification, everything is not possible, even in Kali Yuga. I remember a lecture, you know, when Prabhupada said, you know, he said it's forbidden. He said, no, not forbidden, but, you know, not possible, you know, minimum we can do. So it's the same with Jagyas, it's like that, you know. Temple worship, we actually do the minimum. Jagya, minimum, you know, therefore, from Prabhupada's time, weddings, you know, and very simple, initiation, you know, there's some scars, they're jagyas, like that. But minimum.
There's droughts in New South Wales and Queensland at the moment.
Get me a ticket, I'll go up there. You are all self-controlled, well-balanced, and chant Hare Krishna. There's a drought up there. Where are they chanting? They're probably all chanting. It's probably raining in the spot where they are. They need to get out in the country. You're all self-controlled, but as you see, you know, he says, chant Hare Krishna and give up your sinful life. In other words, Prabhupada's saying they need to take the Hare Krishna movement seriously, the people. You know, then they'll get the results. That has to be part of the process.
I was reading they waste a lot of water just washing down trucks that transport animals from farms to the other parts.
The meat industry,
yeah,
apart from the droughts, not growing, it uses massive amounts,
yeah,
of water. If you ever go to the abattoirs, I don't recommend it, but to keep it sterile,
mm-hmm,
is this constant washing, massive amounts of water and steam, constantly,
mm-hmm,
massive amounts of water to keep things because of all the trucks, every aspect of it, constantly.
Trucks have so much excretion from animals.
Yeah. So, you are self-controlled, well-balanced in mind and aware of the absolute truth, and because of austerities and penances, you are completely cleansed of all material contaminations. Your words, like those of the demigods, are never baffled. Then how is it possible that your determination has failed? The most powerful grandfather of his sister, after hearing these words of Manu, understood the discrepancy on the part of the priest. Thus he spoke as follows to the son of the sun god. This discrepancy in the objective is due to your priest's deviation from the original purpose. However, by my own prowess, I shall give you a good son. Sukadeva Goswami said, O King Parikit, after the most famous and powerful of his sister made this decision, he offered prayers to the Supreme Person Vishnu to transform Ila into a male. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supreme Controller, being pleased with Vasistha, gave him the benediction he desired. Thus Ila was transformed into a very fine male called Sujumna. O King Parikit, that hero, Sujumna, accompanied by a few ministers and associates and riding on a horse brought from Sindhu Pradesh, once went into the forest to hunt. He wore armor and was decorated with bows and arrows, and he was very beautiful. While following the animals and killing them, he reached the northern part of the forest. There in the north, at the bottom of Mount Meru, in a forest known as Sukumara, where Lord Shiva always enjoys with Uma, Sujumna entered the forest. O King Parikit, as soon as Sujumna, who was expert in subduing enemies, entered the forest, he saw himself transformed into a female, and his horse transformed into a mare. It's a female horse. When his followers also saw their identities transformed and their sex reversed, they were all very morose and just looked at one another. Imagine that happening. Imagine we all walk out of Bhaktivedanta, we've all changed sex. It's quite, you know. O most Parikit, in Kali Yuga, no one would notice. O most powerful Brahmana, why was this place so empowered? And who made it so powerful? Kindly answer this question, for I am very eager to hear about this. Sukadeva Goswami answered, great saintly persons who strictly observe the spiritual rules and regulations and whose own effulgence dissipated all the darkness of all directions once came to see Lord Shiva in that forest. When the goddess Ambika saw that the great saintly person, she was very much ashamed because at that time she was naked. She immediately got up from the lap of her husband and tried to cover her breast. Seeing Lord Shiva and Parvati engaged in sexual affairs, all the great saintly persons immediately desisted from going further and departed for the ashram of Nara Narayan. Thereupon, just to please his wife, Lord Shiva said, any male entering this place shall immediately become a female. Since that time, no male had entered that forest, but now King Sujumna, having been transformed into a female, began to walk with his associates from one forest to another. Sujumna had been transformed into the best of beautiful women who excite sexual desires and was surrounded by other women. Upon seeing this beautiful woman loitering near his ashram, Buddha, the son of the moon, immediately desired to enjoy her. The beautiful woman also desired to accept Buddha, the son of the king of the moon, as her husband. So there we go. We know the king of the moon, and he's got a son called Buddha. Thus, Buddha begot in her womb a son named Pururava. I heard from reliable sources that King Sujumna, the son of Manu, having thus achieved femininity, remembered his familial spiritual master, Vasistha. Upon seeing Sujumna's deplorable condition, Vasistha was very much aggrieved. Desiring for Sujumna to regain his maleness, Vasistha again began to worship Lord Sankara Shiva. O King Prithvi, Lord Shiva was pleased with Vasistha. Therefore, to satisfy him and to keep his word to Parvati, Lord Shiva said to that saintly person, "Your disciple Sujumna may remain a male for 1 month and a female for the next. In this way, he may rule the world as he likes."
There's
no getting out of that one, is it? Thus, being favoured by the spiritual master, according to the words of Lord Shiva, Sujumna regained his desired maleness every alternative month, and in this way ruled the kingdom, although the citizens were not satisfied with this. Even they weren't happy. O King Sujumna had three very pious sons named Utkala, Gaya and Vimala, who became the kings of the Dakshinapatha. Thereafter, when the time was right, when Sujumna, the king of the world, was officially old, he delivered the entire kingdom to his son Pururava and entered the forest. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 9th canto, 1st chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, titled King Sujumna Becomes a Woman. Here we go.
What's the lesson we learn from this?
What we learn from that is it's here that in their purport to text 33, it says, in the Bhagavad Gita 2.22, as a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul accepts new material bodies, giving up the old ones, useless ones. The body is just like a dress, and here that is proved. So Sujumna and his associates were all male, which means that their souls were covered by a male dress, but now they become female, which means that their dress changed. The soul, however, remains the same. It is said that by modern medical treatment, a male can be transformed into a female and a female into a male. The body, however, has no connection with the soul. The body can be changed either in this life or the next. Therefore, one who has knowledge of the soul and how the soul transmigrates from one body to another does not pay any attention to the body, which is nothing but a covering dress. Pandita Samadarshana, such a person sees the soul, which is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, therefore he is a Samadarshi, a learned person. So that's the point of it, is we understand that the body is just a covering dress, we're the spirit soul, and we need not have paid too much attention to the covering dress of the soul. But, you know, a lot of people, of course, when they do have sex changes in Kali Yuga, it is because they feel that their spiritual essence is, they may feel my spiritual essence is female, or they may feel my spiritual essence is male. But that actually has nothing to do with the person. Literally, it's just a bodily covering. And the subtle body is just an undergarment.
Having said that, the king, he could, the when he was female, he could not rule the kingdom. But if it's just a covering, why could he do his job even in a female body? But they said that he was ruling only when he was a male. But he was not ruling when he was a female.
Well, there's another thing we can learn. No, but that when we accept these bodies, And that's why Krishna says, why, you know, we've concentrated chaturvanam ayasrisvara. It doesn't matter whether one has a sudra's body, a vaishya's body, a chatur's body. One should do the work as devotees. Anyone on this planet should do the work according to the body and the subtle body one has accrued. So if one is a woman, they should actually do the work, understanding, I have a woman's body. One is a man, I should do the work, understanding, I have a man's body. I have a, you know, a strong physical body that, you know, and a lot of physical energy. I need to work hard all day, and I don't like to sit down and intellectually think. Then do that type of work. But it makes no difference. That the body, the dress that we are in, even though we're transcendental to it, still it actually forces us to act in certain ways. So for instance, you know, if the body is limited in a particular way, say you lose your right arm, or you lose both arms. Let's make it interesting. I won't go any further. Your leg, no. Say you've lost two arms. You know, you're not going to do much typing. You know? You're not going to do much writing. Very hard. Even though you're transcendental, you're completely transcendental to that body, but you're still not going to do something because your body is not suitable to that activity. Your body is suitable. Now, let us say, what is a body with no arms suited for? Give me some suggestions.
No, even in Bhutan, there have been ladies who have been rulers.
Yeah. But the point is, there's two things there. One, we can do work suited to our body and our psychophysical makeup, even though we're transcendental to it. And two, we understand it is a covering, but just like Arjun was asked to fight. That was the form he had, and Krishna was asking him to fight. He didn't ask Vyasadeva to fight. He didn't ask Sukadeva Goswami to fight, or Narada Muni asked. So, therefore, but that is not treating a devotee, that is not treating Arjun in a materialistic way, that, oh, you have this body, will treat you like a kshatriya. You see? So there are many, you know, it's having the body, being transcendental and still utilizing it in the way the body is best suited, most natural. That's usually the best course. Okay? Let's leave it there, and with that verse, Bhagavad Gita 4.13, very important, because all those verses, Prabhupada says, all those verses in the fourth chapter of transcendental knowledge, understanding Krishna's position and how we act according to the transcendental position with Krishna, it all is centered around that verse, Chaturvanyam Mayasvara. All those verses right through to the end. Very important verse. Okay, let him in. Open the doors. Put down the drawbridge.